We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Audacy put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Audacy. Visit ads.audacy.com.
Feeling very like slow-mo 80s montage right now. Like I'm on a beach, there's wind going through my hair, my six-pack is showing. Just kidding, I don't have one of those. Welcome back to Sports Talk Saturday. Nate Geary here. Let's go to the Western Hotline now because there is just kind of news happening all over the place. So I'm going to bring John Scott now of Spectrum TV. He joins me now at Spectrum Sports on the Western Hotline. John, you were just a part of the MAC conference. The MAC president was doing his press conference after the announcement today that the Mid-American Conference is officially canceling the football season. First and foremost, good morning, John. Secondly, tell us a little bit about what you heard on the press conference today and just how disappointed the MAC conference really is.
Yeah, it was an emotional decision. The commissioner of the Mid-American Conference, John Steinbrecher, actually started getting choked up when talking about it as the 30-minute or so Zoom call just wrapped up within the past minute or so. He said he's crushed, and he said that if you asked him back in March if we would be where we are today, he wouldn't have believed it. And I just tweeted that out, and I think we all can agree. None of us particularly could have envisioned this pandemic affecting as long and the way that it has. So they made the tough decision that was unanimously voted between all the presidents of the universities in the MAC to postpone all fall sports with the hope and vision to then have them be played in the spring. And then moving forward, the question is how will that affect things in 2021,
yeah,
the traditional fall schedule? And that is to be determined. Players, coaches, medical professionals, they're going to use the input from all of them to map out a 12-month plan, is what he referred to it as, to make sure that they can do the spring and also not interrupt and affect the fall too much.
If you had to put a percentage on the season actually playing out in the spring, like what would you put that percentage on?
It's crazy because I'll go back to what he said. If you asked these questions in March, I mean, I was supposed to get married at the end of June. I thought that I would be fine. And then you get to May and you're like, well, there's no way that's going to happen. And so then it's like, as we sit here in early August, I want to be optimistic and say we got to get through this after a full year of dealing with the pandemic. But the pandemic has shown that we can't predict what's going to happen. So I would go 50-50 at this point just because I want to believe that science and the health world will find a way for us to get back to normal life just across the board, which would then allow these fall sports to go forward in the spring. But there's just so much unknown, and I've learned enough through this to say you really can't say anything for certain in regards to the future.
John, if you were trying to explain to people the financial ramifications of the MAC conference losing out some of their marquee matchups, and let's use the University of Buffalo going to Ohio State or Penn State, right? Like those are sort of some marquee matchups that UB has had over the last couple of years, set to take on Ohio State this year. From a financial perspective, what does losing a game like that actually do for the universities? Because I think sometimes people have a difficult understanding of how much financially those teams count on that type of money.
Yeah, I don't know for sure, but I know it's a million, if not more, is what the quote-unquote, they're referred to as buy games are. So Ohio State pays UB $1 million or more to come to Columbus in the beginning of the season, and they're meant for the bigger programs as tune-ups, almost like a preseason game, but it gets incredible exposure for the university. We saw what that exact game in Columbus did for Khalil Mack. I wasn't in Buffalo. I didn't know anything about UB, and to see a linebacker for that school outrun Braxton Miller and the running back, who's supposed to be the fastest guy on the team, and he outran them. And then you have Todd McShay doing sidelines saying, well, this guy could be a top 10 pick. Like, that put Khalil Mack on the national map. And there are some very good players on this UB football team, led by Jarrett Patterson, who would have greatly benefited from going up against a team like that on a national scale. And it could have really propelled him into the forefront of the eyes of NFL people and the country. So there's the economics of, yes, like, they just built a field house. They need to continue to infuse money, because you're not getting that from the revenue of ticket sales when you're facing Eastern Michigan on a Thursday night in November. So losing games like that and Big 12 opponents and things like that, I mean, we're talking millions of dollars. And the conference as a whole is losing, it could potentially be taking a massive hit from postponing things to the spring. But the commissioner said at this point, those exact numbers are to be determined.
John Scott here on the Wester Hotline. John, let's talk a little bit about, too, what the ramifications might be. Today we see the Big Ten is meeting together today with, quote-unquote, all options on the table. Are you kind of at the point now, you know, kind of listening to what the MAC conference president had to say, knowing the Ivy League has already canceled fall sports for the year? Do you get the sense, based on what you were hearing from a non-Power 5 school, which I think is important to understand, that they are non-Power 5 and there is a different level of economics that happen in the MAC conference opposed to like a conference like the SEC, who has significant broadcasting dollars, significant there is literally economies of cities and towns at stake here. Do you get the sense, though, that these other Power 5 conferences are going to be in a situation where they almost have to follow suit with what we're seeing with the MAC and prior to them, the Ivy League?
Well, the interesting thing is all the Power 5s have released their schedule, I believe, and they have already made the decision that it's conference only, I believe. Now, maybe the ACC, I think Syracuse has a non-conference against Liberty at the Dome, so maybe, but they've really shrunk the schedule and allowed them to focus themselves and have given some breathing room of sorts to push things off. Because you're right, economically, it's a different game for them. But here's another thing, and we started seeing it this week. Micah Parsons is a potential top five prospect for Penn State. He has already opted out of the season, and that's as things are scheduled in the fall. You push things to the spring, why is Trevor Lawrence going to play? Why is Justin Fields going to play? Why are any of these guys who are eligible to enter the NFL draft, why would they play in the spring? And frankly, how would that even work with the NFL Combine usually in late February, the Senior Bowl at the end of January? Maybe those things, we won't be at a point where those will be able to happen, but if Trevor Lawrence wants to be considered, or Justin Fields as a, you know, the top player selected, I don't think you can be playing college football in April when the draft is in April. So I don't know. This kind of has a feeling today of what we felt that second week in March when you saw the smaller conferences start to cancel their men's and women's basketball tournaments, and then within 24, 48 hours, everything was done. And I want to be more hopeful, but you kind of get a sense when you see a tweet about the Big Ten gathering and they've delayed padded practices. They're not starting like they were supposed to this week, and they don't particularly know when that's going to happen. So if you're not in padded practices and you're supposed to start playing in a month, it feels like we're on our fingertips grasping on and hanging over the edge.
Yeah, it does sort of feel like it's almost inevitable, and what we're doing now is just trying to find new ways to delay that inevitable. And it's unfortunate because, like, I know that when we talk about the economics of college football, that a lot of times we get to a place where we're like, okay, well, these college athletes aren't getting paid. This is sort of ridiculous. But you really start to realize, like, Tuscaloosa, right? Like, that economy runs because of Alabama football. And, you know, you start to wonder what happens to the local places of these small towns that have large college football. I mean, that is pro sports to them. So there is going to be a lot of there's going to be aftershock of if college football is forced. And it, frankly, John, that's kind of where we're at right now is I think college football teams, college presidents, the NCAA as a whole, they're almost sort of being forced now to really kind of look at themselves in the mirror and say, is this something that we can sell to people, that we're going to go ahead because we can't find a way to lose this money, that we're going to go out on a limb and put these college athletes who aren't being paid, who don't really have the necessary safety measures in place. We were talking about this morning, John, like the Red Sox, right? Their good young pitcher, Edwin Rodriguez, is out for the season because of long-term health issues he's having from getting COVID. That is, to me, the one thing I keep thinking about is if one of these college athletes, a Trevor Lawrence, were to get COVID and have long-term breathing issues, I don't know, like something that we just don't know about this disease yet, like what that could potentially do to the career arc of a player who's likely going to go number one overall. I just wonder if the NCAA is almost forced to look at themselves like, this is tough, we don't want to lose out on the revenue, but like, we're going to look worse if we put these kids in a bad situation.
Absolutely, and that's what the MAC commissioner said. He repeatedly said, this is a health and well-being decision. It is not a financial decision. It's not a decision that they wanted to make, but when they talked to the medical and listened to the medical people that they trust and hire, they all came to the same conclusion of, we cannot assure our student athletes that they will be safe. And because of that, then they just have to rip the Band-Aid off and accept the reality and hope that they can still allow these student athletes, especially at a you know, mid-major level like the MAC or something. I mean, the majority of these kids, their football careers are going to end after this. It's not like many will have pro aspirations and opportunities. So hopefully in these sports beyond football, you know, cross country and soccer and things like that, they will get that opportunity in the fall. But it was, he emphasized repeatedly, the MAC commissioner, that this is a health and well-being issue. And I think it goes right to what you're saying. Yes, it is their number one responsibility to keep them safe, their players and their student athletes. And at least the Mid-American Conference doesn't feel that they can actually do that.
Spectrum Sports, John Scott here on the Western Hotline. John, let's transition over to the Bills, who we started to actually see and hear from this week as many players were meeting with the media. First and foremost, I want to start with Josh Norman, because he's kind of the name that I know a lot of people talk about and are really intrigued on what he's actually going to be able to bring to the table. What kind of sense did you get from Josh Norman about maybe why he felt like Buffalo was the right decision and right move for him at this point in his career? Because, I mean, a lot of us know at this point he's no spring chicken. He is sort of at the twilight of his career. What do you believe, based on what you heard from him, gives him the confidence that this is the system, this is the group where you think maybe he can refine and reclaim some of the success he had earlier in his career?
Well, he has a lot of people and went through a lot of people to get an understanding of what this organization and what this team is like. He mentioned his familiarity with Brandon Bean and Sean McDermott, obviously another Carolina connection. We heard earlier in the week from Jordan Poyer, and Norman dove into it a little bit. They spoke for over an hour, and they've known each other for years, and spoke for over an hour about Buffalo and about the team and about the defense. He also mentioned people like Kirk Coleman, another guy he knew from Carolina, Dean Marlowe, another guy he knew from Carolina. And then he just looked at this team, and he said their aggressive way of doing things defensively is what perfectly fits him and his style. And he said, I'm a guy who produces turnovers, and if I can come in here and produce a few more turnovers, this defense, with the best secondary in the league, according to him, can continue to be and maybe elevate to the best unit in the National Football League. And he also made a point when asked, like, do you think that you can and should be a starter? He says, that's always been my mentality, and that's not going to change, but we're going to compete. And if it doesn't work out and I'm not the starter, and, you know, let's say Levi Wallace is is better for the job. He ultimately is here to win a championship. A guy who's 33 years old, the back end of his career, that's his main focus. And so he's at least saying that he's willing to accept whatever role he is given if it best suits the Bills for their pursuit of a Super Bowl.
John, you know, and sticking with Norman, you know, he definitely had the opportunity on his conference call or his Zoom session to kind of throw some of the issues that he had in Washington and maybe throw guys, individuals, or a scheme or coaches under the bus. And I did find it, I respected the fact that he had that opportunity and decided not to. Listen, at the end of the day, guys grow up. He's 33 years old. He's not the same guy he was in 2015. So with that being said, were you surprised that, you know, given the opportunity that Josh really has sort of embodied what it means to play for a Sean McDermott team and not make it about himself and always kind of keeping that best foot forward mentality? And I think it showed in some of his answers when he was asked about his time in Washington.
Right. The quote that I took from him, he said, at the end of the day, I take a lot of bullets and I don't come out and shoot back. And so that's, you don't want, this team isn't about, this organization, this culture, the Bills, is not about rocking the boat. And, you know, from a media standpoint, we like to get some sort of juice. And sometimes when it's company line all the time, that can get frustrating. Norman is not a company line guy. I mean, he gave plenty of what I thought were honest and great answers. But he took a route that Stephon Diggs took the day before and said, I don't want to discuss what was in the past. He did mention he got a lot of flack for things that he feels were out of his control. And maybe, you know, people that go to the film and maybe say, and I've heard this, I don't know for sure, said that the scheme in Washington didn't fit him like it did in Carolina under Sean McDermott. So I think it's good that Diggs and Norman both didn't take the bait, for lack of a better phrase, and said, you know what, I'm in my new place. I don't want to discuss the old place. Let's just move forward. And I think that, to your point, is that's the culture. That's the process. And that's what Sean McDermott has ingrained in this entire roster.
John, you also were there for when Matt Milano met with the media as well yesterday. You know, obviously Matt Milano is kind of in a very key situation for his upcoming career. He's in a contract year. To this point, we have heard almost nothing, just radio silence on whether a deal is currently being worked out with him, with the team and his agent. Having said that, there is, I do think that Milano, John, has gotten to the point of his career and has had the on-field success where he could be in a situation, and it's just not unlike other players in the league to do this who are in similar situations as Milano, especially considering for the value he's brought in the league, he has been a pretty tremendous money value being a late round pick. I mean, this isn't a guy that's making $1 million a year. Are you a little surprised that maybe he isn't making a bigger deal out of this, potentially holding out, something that I know players will do to try to create some leverage to get a deal done? But this is a player who is pretty monumentally important to this defense and the success they've had over the last 2 or 3 years. So are you at all surprised that he isn't making more of a story of this?
No, and we don't talk with Matt Milano very much because he doesn't usually have a whole lot to say. He's a quieter guy that's keeps to himself, and you know, he'll gladly answer questions when you know we have asked him to do so. And but that doesn't, from the way I have observed him these past few years, it doesn't surprise me at all. I think he's a guy that just wants to play football. And when I asked him about the contract yesterday, he said, "I'm just focused on football, winning a championship. I'll let the business side of things handle themselves, and hopefully the number is." At the end of the day, is what works out well for me. And I followed up and said, "Is your hope to stay in Buffalo?" And he said, "Yeah, I wouldn't want to be anywhere else." It will be interesting with him though, because if we're on a to-do list here, I would put him third. Tre'Davious White, I know that picked up the fifth-year option. I would put him number one. I'd put Deion Dawkins number two, and I'd put Matt Milano number three. And when you look at that, I don't know what he's going to command, but there is a possibility, I think, that he could get priced out for the Bills. because you can't pay everyone. That's the challenge and the harsh reality of drafting well and developing your own talent is ultimately you can't pay them all. And so I think if they can work the money, it'll be, you know, obviously that is their hope on both sides of things, but also with the economic ramifications of the pandemic and the cap dropping and all of that, that I think is truly affecting things as to why renegotiations and extensions are not happening now, because there's so much uncertainty with the numbers of next year. And I think with what is being projected with, you know, maybe $20 million cap going down, then you really got to say, like, could you pay him $8 to $10 million a year, knowing that you're going to have to pay Trey maybe 20, you may have to pay Deion over $10 million bucks a year, and then you got Josh and Tremaine, you got all these guys coming down the line. I just wonder if there's going to be enough of the pie to give Matt Milano the big enough slice that he probably deserves.
John Scott here on the West Tour Hotline. John, before I let you go, I did want to get your overall thoughts on the Tre'Davious White news this week. Obviously, he sort of made headlines on Wednesday suggesting that internally he still hadn't quite firmed up a decision. It felt like it was kind of down to like a 50-50 situation, whether or not he was willing to play this season or whether or not he would be one of the, geez, I think it ended up being 66 overall players that opted out for the 2020 season. Did you get this sense, were you at all surprised that after what you heard him and how he phrased things on Wednesday, that he ultimately decided to opt in and play this season? I know, like, one of the guys, Marcel Louis-Jacques of ESPN, was kind of saying he would be surprised after hearing his comments if Tre'Davious White ultimately ended up playing. I kind of felt I was almost probably on the same page as Marcel. I would say that I was going to be surprised if I heard Tre'Davious White did end up playing. So therefore, I was a little surprised to see he's playing. What are your thoughts on obviously his opting in and sort of what you heard from him this week?
Yeah, Marcel and I, we were actually texting the other day on Thursday, and we both were in agreement. Go figure. We actually do agree on things, especially when it's like being bad at golf. I was more leaning towards he was not going to play this year based upon not only what he said, and I thought it was genuine and thoughtful and very reasonable, the things that he was openly discussing with us in regards to how he was processing the potential decision. I think it was genuine and all that. And then you go and add to the fact that the way he responded with a tweet Thursday morning of coming back at people who criticized him for even considering not playing, mm-hmm. I thought it had a tone of, like, deal with it, this is what I'm going to do. And so I'm not going to say I was surprised, but I was, you know, maybe 60-40. I'm like, okay, he's not going to play 60-40. And when it came out that he was, I wasn't floored. But, yeah, I was definitely – he had me leaning the other direction based upon – the way he was discussing things, and then again, it kind of pushed me even a little farther over 50-50 when I read and saw his tweet and the way he was responding to the haters Thursday morning.
Yeah, I agree. I thought that it almost felt like the decision was made. That's why he was sort of dangling it out there. Like, it had felt like the decision had been made and the Bills were going to be scrambling over the next couple of weeks to try to make sure that they had that they were confident with what they had in the room. So for me, and last thing, John, you know, with knowing that he is opting in and that he is going to be playing this season, we talked a little bit about Josh Norman and how his presence on this defense might affect their overall ability this year. Like, where do you stand now? Now that we know that the powers that be, the New England Patriots lose 8 players. So with what we know about who opted out and who's going to play, and let's maybe just focus on the AFC East in this, do you believe the dynamics have ultimately and fully shifted now to this is the Bills division to win based on what we saw? Things had changed a little bit when the Patriots had signed Cam Newton, and now people were like, well, now it's kind of back to New England, and now losing 8 players, including Patrick Chung, Dante Hightower, some really high-key or important players. Do you believe this is the Bills division to lose?
I think that's fair to say. I mean, you look at the roster, just look on paper, which is all we can do at this point. All they've really done is add from last year's team that won 10 games and frankly should have won a playoff game. And that's so you then you add an offense, you add Zach Moss will be better, in my opinion, than Frank Gore. And I adding Stephon Diggs puts everyone, I think, in the receiving group slotted more appropriately. John Brown is good, but he is a great number two. Like he was a solid number one. He is a great number two. If Cole Beasley is a good number two, he is a great number.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.
For free option. And then Dawson Knox said it yesterday. With Diggs on the outside, he's hoping that the middle of the field will be open more for him and maybe Tyler Croft and the tight end game to get running as well. So, and the offensive line, we know Feliciano is out, but I think they can weather that storm, whether it's Brian Winters, Daryl Williams, Ike Butker, Evan Bott, you know, they have a ton of options there. So on paper, offensively, this team should be better, and that's without even taking into, is Josh going to take, how big of a step forward is he going to take? If he stays the same, I still think they can win 10 games and get into the playoffs and potentially win the division. Then the defense, yeah, you lost Shaq and you lost Jordan Phillips, and they deservedly got their money. But you could make the argument that the defensive front is deeper and better now than it has been under Sean McDermott, and they run a heavy rotation. And if you have more talent and depth and versatility now on that front than you did before, that front could actually produce more sacks and be better. And then the secondary is the same. Yeah, I mean, on paper, it should be fine. And frankly, even if Brady was still in the division, Brady was not Brady last year. He still is Brady, but he wasn't someone you couldn't beat. I mean, the Bills should have beat them at least once, probably twice, last season. And now Cam Newton, I see no reason why the Bills can't beat a Cam Newton-led Patriots offense because we haven't really seen Cam Newton do things and stay healthy in Carolina, and is his supporting cast in New England any better than what he had down in Carolina? He doesn't have Christian McCaffrey, and you know, Curtis Samuel is a good wide receiver, DJ Moore. So I think that the Bills should win the division, even if they don't take these ridiculous steps forward into Super Bowl contention, and a lot of that is going to hinder on Josh's development. But the key to me is how does this team handle being in a different position? They love being the underdog. They love the chip on their shoulder. They love everyone banging on Buffalo. But that's not the majority now. Now they're the ones that most believe, well, you should dethrone the Patriots and you should win the division, and let's see what you can do since you have all of this talent. And I'll be curious how they handle being in that seat in the car as opposed to the different one in the back.
Yeah, I do think that's going to be the most interesting thing that I'm maybe most looking forward to, John, starting the season, is how the difference of expectations from the outside world affect the way that they approach, you know, even if it's just preparation and some of the, it is going to be a very, very different world for this Buffalo Bills team, obviously with everything going on with COVID, but the expectations being maybe higher than they've been, at least in my lifetime, I am really interested to see how the team sort of responds to that. But John, thanks so much, man. Appreciate all the time this morning, getting us up to date with everything going on in the MAC conference. And thanks for joining us, man. We appreciate it. And we'll talk to you soon.
For sure, man. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you. John Scott there of Spectrum Sports. So find him on Spectrum News on TV as well. 803-0551, 888-552-550. PGA Championship Talk coming up next with Jeff Mitis from Tee to Green on WGR. Welcome back to Sports Talk Saturday. Nate Geary here. We continue on our guest list for our 12:30 guest here with Jeff Mitis. He is a host on our morning program every Saturday, Tee to Green, which you can hear 7 to 8. And of course, if you missed any of today's show, it was an extended major show. It's on WGR550.com, on-demand audio. Jeff joining me now on the West Tur Hotline. Jeff, first and foremost, good afternoon, my friend. How are you?
Good afternoon, Nate. I see you're starting to post some good scores, huh?
It's about damn time. Yeah, I mean, I've been spending enough time, hacking it up into the course. Finally, I've turned the corner on the putting greens, which has been the major difference in my scoring lately. And I think, hell, that was a great segue. It's almost like you do radio, too. You got me talking putting, which has really kind of been the talk around Tiger Woods, which is obviously the guy we're going to start talking about with this major underway this weekend, who Tiger, even through two rounds, made the cut yesterday, and will be teeing off at 1 o'clock today. But the story through the first 2 days has been, A, his putter use. What putter is he going to use? And, B, his inability to make putts over 4 feet over the first two rounds has really kind of held his scoring back. Were you at all surprised yesterday, and maybe even more so Thursday, when you saw the conditions? Everybody seemed to be making those long putts. A lot of players after the rounds commenting on how the greens were very fair on Thursday. And I think it was yesterday, maybe it was Tommy Fleetwood after the round or Brooks Koepka, who was talking about how they could almost see mid-round that the greens were sort of turning like that purple color, meaning that the greens were definitely getting quicker and faster, and we could probably expect that through the rest of the weekend. So with that being said, Tiger's going to have a long weekend if he can't figure out his putting game.
Yeah, you know, I've been watching him play golf for a long, long time, and he's the greatest putter I've ever seen. And it's peculiar, I guess. I don't know if it's peculiar. He switched putters before a major championship. He's in his 40s. It's not that vastly different a putter. He's struggling. He's looking for something. Thursday, he had a decent day, I thought, putting. And Friday, he couldn't make, it looks like he's hitting them where he's aimed. He's hitting them with good speed. My thought is he's not reading them like he used to, maybe. And he's just not making putts. I don't know what's going on there. If he could, he'd be right near the lead, I think.
Yeah.
And that'd be very, very exciting. He's two or three putts away from being, in contention. Does it mean he can't get hot this weekend? He certainly can. I don't know. I never, ever, ever write. I've written off Tiger five times in his career already, and he just keeps coming back. So I wouldn't be surprised from anything from him today. But it is a major championship, and the greens are supposed to be firm and fast. And today's, I actually just retweeted the pin sheet for today. It looks like, looking at it, it looks daunting because there's no easy pins. So if he can have a good ball striking around and get hot early with his putter, who knows what he could do? He's the best player that ever lived.
So, Jeff, I mean, yesterday I was golfing in the afternoon. I got home, flipped on, I think, right around where the Tiger, Rory, and JT group was getting to number 8. And, I ended up watching Tiger birdie number 10, and I'm thinking, okay, back 9, this is looking good for this group. But holy cow, did the wheels fall off. JT ends up doubling, I think, 14. Rory triples number 14. Like, the wheels fell off of that group starting right at number 13. What did you see from those guys that really, was it mental? Was it the changing of the conditions? I know wind really became a factor late, but that group really fell apart and fell apart quick.
Well, I don't think any of them are firing on all cylinders right now. They didn't, they weren't playing their best. It was a little bit of smoke and mirrors for some of them. And I mean, it was decent ball striking. JT's the number one player in the world. Is Rory number 2 now or 3?
Yeah, I think he's number 3.
Yeah. Yeah, and then Tiger. So these are the best players in the world. It's the PGA Championship. It's difficult conditions. You miss fairways, and it's tough to play well. Even if you're swinging well, if your driver is a foot into the rough, now you got to grind to just make a par, and everything's a little different. So, and that's what it's supposed to be. But it's also easy. If you hit the fairways, guys are shooting good scores. You're seeing some 65, 66s. And, you know, it's hard, but it's fair. And that's how it's always been set up at the PGA Championship.
So, Jeff Mead is here on the Wester Hotline, a host in the mornings for our Tee to Green show, of course, which you can hear regularly from 7 to 8 a.m. on Saturday mornings. You know, I kind of look at the top of this leaderboard, and there are names that everybody kind of recognizes. Koepka, Jason Day, both at 6-under, two strokes off the lead. Justin Rose, who I thought played really, really well, especially towards the end of his round last night. The name, though, at the top of the leaderboard, Haotong Li, out of China, played a really, really solid round two. The story, though, throughout the whole evening, it seemed like the ESPN broadcast kept sort of phasing back to the range to see Lee on the driving range up until almost 9 p.m. Eastern. What were your thoughts about that? I thought it was really interesting. They kept sort of adding to the point where, what is he still doing in here? He played this morning, apparently had went home, took a nap, ate, but came back and was at the range for over 5 hours after putting together a grinded out type of round with two to play. What was kind of your feedback? What were you thinking when you're seeing a guy, and maybe put yourself in the position of his caddy or his coach? Is that something you want to be doing with two important rounds remaining in a major?
Yeah, they were highlighting it because it is a bit peculiar. You know, the best time to practice is after your round. That's what most of the players do. If you had something go wrong, you go to the range, you try to fix it. You know, you make some swings until you get it right, or you didn't hit this shot well. I think it's nervous energy. I think, you know, he's a good player. He's, 114th in the world. He's played on the President's Cup or something. I think he had a top five finish in the British Open, but I think it's nervous energy. I think he's uncomfortable. I think if he's sitting in his room, he probably feels like he needs to be productive. So he wants to go back to the range, and he wants to make sure he's giving it every effort he can because he's got a unique opportunity in front of him. But at some point, there's diminishing returns there. And if I was his caddy, or if that were me, I mean, you can only do so much. You start to fatigue, and I would rather go home. I kind of work on the things I didn't do well and hit some shots and build my confidence and a few chips and putts, and then boom, back home and rest and get a good meal and get ready for tomorrow. If I was in his ear at all, I probably would have told him to go home a lot earlier. But I don't know if that's out of character for him either, because he's been, I don't know this player. Maybe he does this every week of the year, all year on the PGA Tour. But I don't think so, or they wouldn't have been highlighting it the way it was on the television show.
Jeff, let's kind of switch gears to the conditions for the rest of the weekend. Today, obviously, the guys later on that are at the top of the leaderboard are going to be teeing off kind of right in the middle of when the winds are supposed to pick up in San Francisco. The forecast has them at 18 miles per hour right around 2, 3 o'clock. Tiger tees off at 1 with wind gusts up to 25 miles per hour. With where they are, how do you expect to see that actually affect scores, considering the greens are definitely drying up? And when you consider if there's a left or right wind and you've got greens that have dried up a bit and they're rolling, how difficult does it make it for these guys, even though they're the best in the world, trying to hold greens when you've got a club down or maybe try to hit more knockdown shots to combat the wind?
Well, the wind is what makes it hard. It's a huge variable. Rain is not really a problem to play in. You know, it's consistent. The wind being gusty, the wind blows the ball around. It's hard to predict where the wind's coming from sometimes as a player, where you're standing on the tee, if it's swirling around. And this is the PGA Championship. This is a major. These are firm fairways. You're going to have to be working it back into the wind as much as possible. Now, that's where a guy like Tiger probably has an advantage, because he's one of the best players to ever play, and he worked it both ways throughout his career, and he's doing it quite well right now. So the guys who have one stock shot, it might be a little harder for them at times. Like if they only hit a draw or something like that, there might be shots that are uncomfortable, and you hope you hit a good tee shot so you have a good angle for an approach, but you're going to have to fight through it. Scores are certainly going to go up. If the wind's blowing on a Saturday at a major championship, they're trying to firm things out, scores will definitely go up. If there was no wind, scores might go down or stay the same because they played for a few days and they're getting used to the conditions. But the wind's going to be the biggest variable, and who faces the most wind is going to have the hardest time scoring, that's for sure.
So the wind is obviously part of the major championship, but so is the rough, Jeff. And at 3 inches, there has been several instances where guys have either picked a wrong club. You've even seen instances of things that, like, one of us might do on a golf course, which is, I mean, I'm in such a tough position here. I'm not going to be able to hit the green. I've got to really pick a lofted club and just get this in play and hope that I can save par. How much does that come into play on a Saturday where hitting the ball straight becomes a premium shot in your bag? And if you can't, what kind of changes do you need to make in your game? Does that mean maybe you got to put the driver away and try to hit three wood just so that you can stay in the middle of these fairways and sort of take out the difficult shots that it really does create in some of the thicker rough?
Well, the rough's not going to be any shorter on Sunday, so it's going to be the same thing on tomorrow. I think certainly it's been a premium throughout the championship, and it's supposed to be that way in the majors of hitting the fairways. And it's going to put more and more of a premium on hitting the fairways and their short game. I said this morning on the radio show, every time I watch major championship golf is when I'm most impressed with these players and I'm most impressed with their short games. So being reliant, getting up and down, keeping the ball in play, 3 inches of that rough out there is pretty thick. And these guys are creating a lot of speed with a lofted club and they're still struggling to get it out. So, it's difficult. I don't know if I would tell a player, it depends on the player, whether you club down and try to keep it in the fairway. To me, that's playing a little conservative. You're trying to win a major championship here. You got to play well, and you got to play aggressively, and you got to make birdies. So you're probably going to still want a bomb driver out there as much as you can, and that's a factor for everybody to figure out on what's going on in their own game. But if you're not firing on all cylinders, you're not going to win anyway. So I think you'll still see them hitting drivers as much as possible because distance and proximity to the hole is still an advantage.
All right, Jeff, I appreciate it, my friend. Thanks for hopping on and talking some golf. I look forward to what is going to be a fantastic finish this weekend. Hopefully the weather holds up and we can see some high scores get posted, or I should say low scores get posted here over the weekend. So thanks for your time, my friend. I appreciate it as always, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right, great talking to you, Nick.
All right, Jeff Mitas there on the Wester Hotline. He's a co-host of Tee to Green every Saturday morning, which you can hear right here on WGR from 7 a.m. to 8 a.m. They had a special two-hour PGA Championship special from 9 to 11. That was this morning. So if you missed any of that, of course, you can go to WGR550.com. Check it out there in on-demand audio. Quick timeout. I'm going to preview hour three coming up next. We will at some point hear from University of Buffalo Athletic Director Mark Allnut and UB football coach Lance Leipold. All of that should be coming up in hour three as well, so you can hear all that right here on Sports Talk Saturday on WGR. All right. Tying a bow, putting a bow on top of hour two of Sports Talk Saturday here. Nate Geary, thanks to Jeff Mitas and, of course, to John Scott last hour for joining me talking a little MAC action, some action, as the Mid-American Conference today has officially postponed the 2020 football season to much of our disappointment. And then we also had Jeff Mitas on talking a little PGA Championship. Tiger Woods set the tee off just in just a few moments, which you should be able to see, I believe, today on ESPN. I'm not sure exactly sure when ESPN coverage of the PGA Championship will start. I'm going to Google search it and give you a for sure on that. But round three getting underway today. Ho Tung Lee, your leader, on the afternoon at 8 under. He's got a 2-stroke lead. So today, you will be able to see 11-1 ESPN plus 1-4, because that makes, 1-4 today is on ESPN, I believe. I don't know. They're making it very difficult for me to read this. So CBS takes over the program at 4 o'clock. So 1-4, Tiger Woods, if you want to go watch. He tees off in about 5 minutes. That'll be on ESPN. Then at 4 o'clock, things kick over to CBS coverage from 10 a.m. to noon tomorrow, ESPN+, noon to 3 ESPN, and 3 to 9 CBS. So those are your TV schedules for the PGA Championship at TPC Harding Park. I'm Nate Geary. Going to take a quick timeout when we come back. We've got Connor Rogers of Bleacher Report. We're going to talk a little New York Jets. He's our resident Jets expert. They have had quite the offseason. They seem to always have quite the offseason, so we'll talk to Connor and get his thoughts on where the hell they're going this season, because it sort of seems like they're the worst team in the division. So we'll talk to Connor. That's coming up next here on WGR.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.